This is the next version of Global Health Perspectives podcast. My name is Derek Yach. I'm from the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And we've been interviewing people working on the nexus of smoking and major public health problems. Today, it's a real privilege to have Shlomi Madar from Signals Analytics with us. And before we get into the discussion, I think we all have become all too aware that we're living through a global pandemic that we hope we will never again see in our life. During the process, there's obviously a lot of fear, a lot of misconceptions, a lot of fake cures are being pushed out through the internet, through social media. They've become a means of globalizing fake news and maybe contributing increasingly to some of the anxiety out there. What we seek, of course, is sound advice about who is sick, where they are, what are they doing to address their problems, and what should they do. With that in mind, let me just briefly mention Shlomi's background. He comes from a background in military intelligence, where my understanding was the goal was very clear, to identify threats to the country, to guide actions to prevent or mitigate the consequences, and failure meant increased deaths and people being harmed. That very sharp expertise has now been turned into public use through our interaction with Signals Analytics, with a focus on solving real problems in real time. We've been looking at how you build on the incredible expertise that has been developed in using internet searches to detect flu outbreaks over a decade ago and going well beyond them. Last year, during the start of what was an unknown respiratory disease among young people in the US, some leading to deaths among young people, an epidemic that raged between June and December, we turned to Signals Analytics to help us address whether we could develop a system using social media to find out what was truly driving it, what were the misconceptions about the causes, what were truly the outcomes. And in the process, Shlomi will describe how that experience turned into something now of value to this COVID-19 pandemic. So let me turn over to Shlomi, and maybe Shlomi, just give a little bit about your own background and the philosophy of Signals Analytics before turning to the original task which we were working on, and then we can get into how it's evolved to where we are today.
Great. So first of all, thank you for having me on this podcast, Derek. It's a pleasure to be here. By way of background, so as you mentioned, I was an intelligence officer for many years. I later on turned to academia and received my PhD in molecular biology. So I'm quite versed with when it comes to analytics and big data in the context of healthcare. And in recent years, I've been with Signals Analytics, where I head our healthcare practice. And a little bit about Signals, as you mentioned, it was founded by two ex-intelligence experts who saw a lot of overlap between the intelligence world and the business world. And so we're trying to bring the intelligence mindset into our product, which is ultimately an analytics platform that meant to drive both insights and decisions. Now, that mindset includes the four pillars of intelligence, which are timeliness, accuracy, comprehensiveness, and relevancy. Timeliness, obviously, this is something not specifically unique to intelligence. Everything needs to happen fast. This is a very fast-growing a condition that we're dealing with. But even outside of the context of an outbreak, you know, the sense of urgency in healthcare is always there. In terms of comprehensiveness, you want to make sure in intelligence that you put the sensors where the signals are. And right now, most of them are actually found online. It's a process that's been taking place in the last 20 years. So in the intelligence community, you see less and less human intelligence like 007 and more cyber units popping up. And it's no different in the business world. So intelligence go where the signals are, and in the online space offer a very unique and interesting milieu of signals. I'll talk about it in a moment. In terms of accuracy and relevancy, of course, you don't want to boil the ocean. You want to make sure that you have a way to surface only those signals that are relevant to you, and they need to be accurate so you can really understand the whole picture before you come and make decisions. So this is just a little bit, in a nutshell, where the intelligence mindset can really help guide decisions. The one thing that you want to know before you diving into such initiatives is how well can you do in those particular settings. And I think this is something that we've explored a lot, and we have the capacity to capture those signals, and then on top of that, insert the analytics layer. So in that regard, I wish to briefly mention one of our recent projects. I think you touched upon it a little bit. I will elaborate. It was an analytics platform that was built following the vaping-related lung illness outbreak, what we call the E-Valley. And we built that platform in order to detect early signals of future outbreaks. So you already see the resemblance between the E-Valley, the vaping incident, and the COVID-19 outbreak that we're experiencing. So we figured that consumers will share their daily experiences in social media and online forums for various reasons. For example, they will be seeking advice. They're just, sharing their life experiences. This is something we see a lot, mainly with teenagers and younger people, and it's a great source of information. Our assumption, by the way, our underlying assumption which was later validated, was that this type of data appears online earlier than official authorities' announcements. So it really helps you to foresee those type of outbreaks. Before you even start monitoring and gleaning insights, you can actually get a head start, which is obviously now very apparent that it could save a lot of lives in the process.
Shlomi, just I think if you could just mention that is exactly what you saw with the E-Valley outbreak, and maybe just one or two examples of the very early signals before the CDC knew what it was.
Yeah, that's a great point. So actually, when we gleaned, we looked backwards into the data, we were able to track discussions that talk about the use of artificial THC use in vaping as a driver for seizures. So just to remind our listeners, when the E-Valley outbreak was concluded, the culprit was actually something very similar. So it was a synthetic form of vitamin E that was found in CBD and THC vapes. So we were able to track that a year before the outbreak took place. And the point is, if you know how to use data and taxonomies, you can really surface those signals very early on, and for the very least, be prepared for the outbreak once it's at your doorstep.
Yeah. So now, maybe talk about how this evolved, and as you started looking forward, you weren't just finding untoward effects, possibly of vaping, but of a new respiratory condition.
Exactly. So interestingly, the platform also captured COVID-19 related signals. Again, the vaping platform we're talking about. So we had to somehow adapt the taxonomy. However, and taxonomy, it's a collection, I'll just say to our listeners, it's a collection of terms and synonyms that is being generated both by machine learning and human intelligence in order to stratify, classify, and then analyze the information. Without it, the data will be useless. So we already started off with a very good taxonomy that was generated by a group of our collaborators, physicians from the respiratory world. So we have a very robust taxonomy, specifically talking about respiratory adverse events and symptoms. So we had to do some really minor modifications, but it really helped us to glean insights regarding the COVID-19 spread in the context of the vaping community. So they discussed a bunch of different things, such as symptoms, knowledge gaps and misinformations, and drivers of basically public discourse. And actually, throughout the process, what we were able to see that there were four archetypes, I would say, of social writers. So the first one was more self-reporting of symptoms and geolocations. So that was really something interesting, because the type of things that you can glean from such posts is really priceless. Some users, including verified COVID-19 patients, also shared how being ill felt, the locations they visited the days before experiencing these symptoms. So you can really also try and build a timeline of the disease onset in a very bottom-up approach. The other archetype that we saw was vaping-specific health implications. So again, the coverage was focused on the vaping community, so a lot of relevant discussions that are focused on topics such as outcomes of COVID-19 for people who smoke or vape. At this moment, of course, we don't have the control group, just the non-vaping community to compare with, but this is something that we intend to build very soon. I'll talk about it later on. The third group was conspiracy theories and disbelief. And I think this is something very interesting and important when you think about means of controlling information and data. And we know this is a huge problem. So many post writers shared fake or biased news, conspiracy theories that were not really grounded in data. They rapidly gained momentum. That was crazy to see those spike really fast over social media. And some of these writers expressed their disbelief in official authorities based on reports and action that were conducted during the E-Valley outbreak and later turned to be excessive or wrong. So there's also these questions of distrust. And, you know, there's a huge piece that came out this last week, in New York Times, that specifically talk about the spread of conspiracy theories. And this is a great tool to explore that. And sometimes they would use experts who would share some data that might seem true and relevant to the layman. But that's kind of the way that they were able to influence public opinion. And when you try to think about reverse engineer that, if you have access to such knowledge, you can really help to combat that and spread facts, make sure you're relying on reliable sources and so on and so forth. The last point, and then I'll pass it on to you, it's the consumer-based reporting. So many online discussions center around the immediate and, distant future outcomes of the current situation. So shortage of supplies, originating either locally or from the Chinese market, personal impact on their lives and families, and so on and so forth. So I'll pause now. I know that I talked a lot, but if you have any more kind of specific things that you would like me to highlight, just let me know.
Yeah, thanks, Shlomi. And I think that paces a very compelling sense of how this digital platform could, and I think should, complement the more traditional epidemiological surveillance, which obviously remains at the heart of what we need to do, understanding who is infected, who is not infected, who is becoming immune, who is not becoming immune. That is something I would say which we were able to do very well during the 20th century, but it strikes me that adding this dimension is going to be able to understand the real lived experiences of people in real communities, and not just whether they are positive or negative, but how they're responding to the messages in real time. I think one of the things that you showed me was just how people were responding online to fears about the flu vaccine. And maybe you could just mention that as one of the examples of a potential conspiracy or misconception.
Sure. So again, we captured a lot of those conspiracy theories, and it really spanned, you know, different countries and different entities. One example that I would say is the origin of the COVID-19 outbreak. So we know that this is something that came from animals that mammals that were in close proximity to humans. We had, and this is amazing, by the way, as a side note, the sequence of this virus pretty early on. However, this did not stop a lot of conspiracy theories talking about biological warfare, either originating in China or coming from the U.S., although, you know, all the evidence, pinpointed to a whole different story. When it came to vaccines, it's another conspiracy theory that was quite widespread. that this is actually one of the causes for this disease. And you know, we know that the benefits of the flu vaccine, it's now amplified because we know that comorbidities, especially pneumonia and other flu-like symptoms, can really drive this condition into disastrous outcomes, you know, quite fast. So those are examples on how those conspiracy theories can really damage our efforts.
Yeah, just one last question is, I'm sure you've had some interaction with public health authorities, and without going into detail, what kind of response are you getting? Because I would have hoped people would jump at this and want to get it implemented fast.
Yeah, so this is exactly what we're trying to do now. We're in touch with several, I would say, influencers, in lack of a better term, but people representing governments, academia, just people volunteering to help and initiating those task forces. I can tell you that what's really on people's mind right now, a lot of it is related to diagnostics and testing. I think everyone understands that in order for us at some point, getting back to normal, it really depends on how we are able to characterize patients in the communities. So people who have not contracted the disease, people who are carrying the disease but are asymptomatic, people who are still contagious. These are all things that we must know before we start releasing people back to work and back to the community. And in that regard, I see a very positive reaction, because we can really help them use this really goldmine of, when you think about it, of those type of discussions. So I'll share some points that I heard from having those conversations with those leaders. So, for example, we can surface chatter about symptoms and adverse events, including, and this is, I think, where it gets interesting, potential rare ones or otherwise lowly discussed. So just think, you know, during the course of the outbreak, we learned that beyond the big three symptoms, there could be other ones who might be very important and informative for the healthcare authorities. So we had loss of sense of smell and taste, eye redness, and so on and so forth. And sometimes those symptoms could be really telling. Why? Because they may be associated with early signs and early onset of the disease, or rather some symptoms appear after the disease is gone. So these type of things can really be gleaned from this reservoir of discussions of people who are right now contracted the disease or in the process of recovering from it. And if we can even, and this is something that I heard from one of the leaders of those task forces, he said, even if you just give us a few symptoms to investigate, like you tell me that people have mentioned specific, even rare symptoms, we'll be able to design an experiment in the lab or with in clinical settings to test the evidence behind it. Another thing is, just monitoring, adding the numbers together and plotting those adverse events and symptoms over time to really understand frequency and onset, as I mentioned. This could be a very powerful tool, especially when you think about it globally, the amount of data that you can get. Another thing that I think you alluded to, and this is something that a lot of those decision makers take interest in, is to identify the chatter and behavioral patterns of the different subjects. So you mentioned people who are talking about symptoms but are not tested. How can we differentiate between those who are showing symptoms but are not necessarily related to corona versus others who tested positive but are not hospitalized, for example? So we can really build kind of a bank of different personas, different type of conditions. And again, you can it's a continuum. So you can bounce between one persona to the other, and in turn, translate this into something effective, into an effective policy, into a better understanding globally and regionally. How is the disease progressing, and what can we do in order to really help in the recovery efforts? And lastly, I would say, in the context of testing and diagnostics, we can actually monitor specific chatter around testing. So how do people report testing and diagnostics? Do they have any barriers? Would they not go and check themselves for whatever reason? And we can use this information in order to reach out to the people that we then wish to test. So this is just a few examples of what people who we talk to, decision makers, are talking about and how do they see this future COVID platform that we're currently working on can really help them.
Well, thanks, Shlomi, and thanks for all of your insights and your team's work. It was a privilege for me to meet the enormously rich team of computer scientists, molecular biologists in Netanya not too long ago, just while this was starting to get going. And I know that you're all committed to using the capabilities and the brain power to have an impact, all within the spirit of this next few weeks as we head into Easter, Passover, and Ramadan. We're always reminded of the phrase, Pekuach Nefesh, to save a life. The task that we all have before us at this time with no greater focus. I would just end with one last thought that I have when I look at the capabilities the system brings. And that is that we will be in recovery soon, hopefully sooner than we are able to predict. But lingering fears will hamper whether people feel comfortable returning to work, to school, to their social networks. And the discourse that we see in social media will be incredibly important to monitor even in that period, maybe even more so, to be able to ensure that the authorities can put out the kind of sound advice, the kind of clear clarions of what we do, so that we do in fact emerge from this stronger and are able to get on with our lives in ways that will probably never be the same, but are also going to be maybe even stronger. But with that, thank you very much, Shlomi, and we look forward to hopefully seeing this evolve and be taken up into use.
Thank you so much, Derek, and stay safe.
Let me thank you all for listening. And we really urge people who want more information or want to engage in any way and learn more details about the work of Signals Analytics to really contact us via podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And again, my name is Derek Yach. And please stay safe, follow the rules, and maintain your social distance, and we will get through this.